Welcome to Tim Bray's Ongoing Podcast, which is an audio version of a selection of the articles on my blog, also called Ongoing. I'm Tim Bray. You can find the blog at tbray.org. This is pretty well the same story you'd experience by reading it, but some people would rather listen. Here we go. This piece was published on the 12th of June, 2022, and is entitled Demerara Rebellion. I accidentally ended up learning a lot about the Demerara Slave Rebellion of 1823. There's a link there. It's a fascinating set of stories worth sharing, worth learning about. Accidentally? I'd always liked the name Demerara, partly because my dad loved molasses on pancakes, toast, whatever, and so my childhood memories are rich with images of a big sticky black pot of Demerara molasses on the breakfast table. I've recently released a software project I've been working on for a few months and thought I'd use that name, but I did a web search for Demerara and thus discovered the 1823 rebellion. Shame on me for not having known about it. Anyhow, I quickly ran across multiple statements that the rebellion's leader was Kwamina. That's a link to his Wikipedia entry, and loved that name so much that I stole it from my project. Here it is on this blog and on GitHub, and those are both links. Apologies and triggers. I regard myself as reasonably historically literate, but somehow had never learned much about slavery, its culture or economics, or the experience of the enslaved. Again, shame on me. Now, trigger warnings. And I mean all the trigger warnings. This story is full of appalling racism and sexual abuse and sordid death and sickening hypocrisy. Blech. The sources. There's been less published on this than you might think. I recommend starting, as I did, with Account of an Insurrection of the Negro Slaves in the Colony of Demerara. That's a link, by Joshua Bryant, who was an accountant in Georgetown, the colony capital, and a member of the militia that battled the rebels. The link above is to the Internet Archive, where you can read this for free. It was published the year after the rebellion and is thus very fresh. It's much more fair than one might expect, pretty well just the facts, and while the whole thing is implicitly totally racist, I have trouble recollecting anything explicitly racist or mean-spirited from Bryant. The typography is terrible, and the whole book devolves into a series of footnotes that drive the supposed main text into a pathetic couple of lines across the top of the page. But the story is strong, and the images are cool. And here we have three pictures, which are taken from Bryant's account. One shows a bunch of rebel slaves on the attack, and it's entitled Retreat of Lieutenant Brady. The second is called Plate 9, Marine Battalion at Cummingsburg. It shows a bunch of white soldiers standing in a fella in a white on a white horse with a top hat, a couple of them, you know, surveying them. Bryant, the author of the book, was actually a member of this particular battalion. And the third picture is awful. It's a four-piece plate, three of them showing black slaves having been hanged. All four show black slaves having been hanged and left hanging in chains from the gallows as a piece of propaganda. It's entitled The Gallows, Five of the Culprits in Chains as They Appeared on the 20th of September, 1823. The second book is Crowns of Glory, Tears of Blood, The Demerara Slave Rebellion of 1823 by Emilia Viotti da Costa, that's a link to her, published in 1994. It's a serious modern work of history, competently if not beautifully written, impeccably sourced, usefully illustrated. I may read more on the rebellion, but after Bryant and da Costa, I don't feel I really need to get the picture. Below is a picture of a page from da Costa's book, which I borrowed from the public library. More people should take books out of libraries. You should, too. And so it's a nicely typeset page, and one of the charming things is that it's got handwritten pencil notes all around the text from some previous reader, and down the side of the book you can see where I put a whole bunch of sticky notes about things I wanted to write about, and subsequently did write about, what you are now listening to. For books that I want to take notes on and write about, I've become very accustomed to Kindle, which makes this easy, but I was sitting up late working on this one with the help of sticky notes and enjoying the penciled annotations of a previous reader whose identity I'll never know, and thinking, maybe there's something to this physical book idea. The story. Demerara produced cotton, coffee, and sugar on plantations which were long and narrow. One of the narrow ends up against the sea or a big river. The work was labor-intensive, and the labor was slave labor. The slaves were hideously oppressed. Some of the English and Dutch owners were on site, but many were absentees, represented by a local slave driver, the first occasion I've ever had to use that term literally. Around 1800, the London Missionary Society started a well-organized and well-funded effort to bring Christianity to the slaves, teach them to read, to know scripture, and to join the church. Many of the slaves took to this eagerly, and the congregations were large. The plantation owner class hated the missionaries, resisted their arrival, and tried in every way to undermine and circumscribe them. They believed correctly that slaves who could read, and who regarded their souls as the equals of free peoples, would be less tractable. The slave trade was outlawed in 1808. Not slavery, just the extraction of human flesh and blood from Africa. This, and the missionary outreach, were part of a growing anti-slavery movement in Britain, led by Wilberforce. That's a link to William Wilberforce, the famous anti-slave leader. The movement had not been successful in outlawing slavery, but in 1823 they managed to get an order in council which forbade the flogging of female slaves and limited working hours to 9 per day. The colonial administration and the planters hated this and dragged their feet on implementing or even announcing it, but word got out among the slaves, many of whom came to believe they had been given their freedom by the king and that the local administration was keeping it from them. The revolt broke out on the 18th of August, 1823, and was joined by over 10,000 slaves. The level of violence was low. Few of the white planters and administrators were killed or even injured. The governor declared martial law, supplemented his existing military forces by conscripting basically every white male, and sent them out to fight, well-armed and reasonably well-organized. It was all over in less than a week. Many of the slaves who were perceived as leaders were unceremoniously hanged on the spot. And then there was a series of ludicrously unfair show trials, in which basically every slave brought forth was briskly condemned to death. The executions were public and conducted with high ceremony as a propaganda exercise. While the rebellion failed, it may have changed the course of history. But before I come back to that, let's meet the people involved. Dramatis personae. The central figure is Jack Gladstone, that's a link to his Wikipedia entry, the slave who actually led the rebellion. He was Kwame's son, born a slave. As a cooper, a skilled worker, he had considerable scope for travel among the plantations. He was tall and charismatic and passionate, convinced that the slave masters were withholding the king's freedom. I'm going to call him just Jack, because Gladstone was the name of the absentee plantation owner, which slaves inherited by default. He lost his wife Susanna when she was taken as mistress, and yes, that's a euphemism, by a white plantation manager. Jack was captured a few days into the rebellion, and weeks later, given an unusually extended and ceremonious trial with, unlike the other slaves, assistance from an attorney. Many witnesses, both colonialists and slaves, were called. Bryant's book includes a lot of the material from this trial. The testimony made it clear that once the rebellion was ablaze, Jack had taken the lead on multiple occasions in protecting the whites from slaves that had extremely well-founded motivations for inflicting extreme violence on them. Nonetheless, he was sentenced to hang. Not wanting to create a martyr, the colonial governor applied to the king for mercy for Jack and a few other convicted slaves on the grounds of his protection of the whites. The mercy was granted, Jack was sold to another slave owner in Santa Lucia, sent there, and vanishes from history. John Ray was one of, that's W-R-A-Y, was one of the first missionaries in Demerara, arriving in January 1809. He was doggedly determined in the face of the planters' resistance and got considerable support from the administration back in Britain. Eventually, he was successful in reaching out to the slaves and built large and thriving congregations across multiple plantations. His message was not revolutionary and heavily emphasized the Christian duty of obedience and loyalty to the masters. Whatever he said, the message of the equality of souls was implicit in the scripture the slaves had learned to read, and they apparently drew their own highly reasonable conclusions about justice and morality. Moreover, Ray himself treated the slaves with respect as humans, and several of them took up roles as church deacons and catechism instructors. He was proactive in trying to mediate disputes between slaves and masters. He also preached Christian sexual morality, which was being violently contravened every day by the plantation owners, who flagrantly feasted sexually on the infinitely vulnerable black woman they owned. Once again, the slaves could and did draw the obvious conclusion. Finally, he fiercely defended the Sabbath and the right of slaves to attend Sunday service. This was another irritant to the slave owners, who felt entitled to 7 days of work from humans they saw as property. In 1816, under pressure from the colonists, and following on the death of the pious plantation owners who had supported his arrival and residence, John Ray accepted another position in a nearby colony. His replacement, John Smith, and there's a picture, a portrait of John Smith here, arrived in early 1817. Smith took up where Ray left off, enlarging still further the slaves' enthusiasm for and their practice of religion. He is an interesting character, a poor, simple Englishman who perhaps joined the missionary cause mostly in search of a living, a man who became possessed by his mission, a man who was a living lesson that black slaves could and should be treated like humans, a man who became, in private, revolted at the existence of slavery. Smith may have known that the rebellion was about to break out, but was apparently consistent in advising the slaves against it. On the other hand, he angrily refused to join the white militia that was putting the rebellion down. And finally, Kwame. He was born in West Africa and kidnapped away to Demerara with his mother while very young. He was a skilled worker, a carpenter, and early an enthusiastic adopter of Ray's missionary message. He became literate, was baptized in 1808, and was elected deacon in Ray's church. Later, he worked closely with John Smith and his wife. Both Ray and Smith regarded him highly, praising him in their diaries. And now I have a picture of a statue of Kwamina in Georgetown, Guyana. It's unlikely the artist had any reliable sources of what he looked like, but he's carrying a cutlass and a cross hanging from a chain, which that's, you know, an important part of the message. It's a cool statue. When Kwamina's longtime partner Peggy became ill, his slave master refused him time off to care for her. One day after work, he found her dead. Kwamina must have known about the planned rebellion, but when it broke out, he strongly advised the slaves to wait for the king's freedom to be proclaimed, but they didn't. We don't know if he participated in the rebellion, although the colonial government repeatedly proclaimed he was the ringleader. We do know that he swore he would never be taken alive by the whites, that on September 16th, he was tracked down by a colonial military party, ignored their orders to stop, and was shot dead. The aftermath. Jack Gladstone's trial was not the main legal event. John Smith was arrested and charged with having promoted, quote, discontent and dissatisfaction in the minds of the Negro slaves towards their lawful masters, managers, and overseers, end quote, and various other charges. He was brought to trial before a court-martial in October 1823. Smith represented himself and consciously turned the trial into a piece of political theater. It's a hell of a story, nicely told in the book by Da Costa. The court-martial found Smith guilty and issued the usual death sentence, but an appeal for mercy was sent to the king across the sea. Mercy was granted, but Smith died of consumption in prison before the mercy arrived, which led to a huge scandal back in Britain, where Smith was presented as a saint martyred by the cruel, grasping plantation owners. The narrative had the advantage of being pretty well the truth. While you can argue about details and might have beens, historians seem to feel that the white-hot scandal around the trial significantly advanced the anti-slavery cause, leading inexorably to the Slavery Abolition Act 10 years later. So Kwamina and Ray and Smith, and especially Jack, may not have won their battle, but pretty clearly they helped their side win the war. Things I learned. Reading old books is good, but aside from that, the abolition of the slave trade, well before that of slavery, was a big deal economically, because for a slave owner, it was much cheaper to buy a slave off the boat than it was to raise a baby slave into adult servitude. Also, a lot of the female slaves were unenthusiastic about bringing children into their life of slavery, so without a fresh crop of victims from Africa, the labor force tended to decline, so of course there was plenty of illegal slave smuggling. Manumission, the freeing of slaves, was not terribly uncommon, but became much rarer after the abolition of the trade. Still, it's unsurprising that the population of free black people in Demerara grew vigorously, but free didn't work with the plantation economy. You probably already have a bad opinion of colonial plantation slave owners. The more you learn about them, the more you'll loathe them. I absolutely cannot begin to understand how people could live in that role and look at their own faces in the mirror. The abuse, violence, exploitation, and rape was continuous and egregious and probably worse than a hyper-overprivileged person like me can imagine. The white-hot screeds against the missionaries and the evils that they would inflict by teaching humans to read and exposing them to Christian scripture are astonishing. I quote, begin quote, "Our colonies are now inundated with canting, hypocritical tailors, carpenters, tinkers, cobblers, etc., who, too lazy to work for an honest livelihood in the mother country, and charmed with the idea of living in ease and luxury abroad, found it very convenient to become converts to the new light and volunteer to teach the gospel without the ability to spell one of its verses," end quote. Sounds like a bottom-feeding GOP politician snarling at wokeness. The planters made a lot of money, for a while. Then they became victim to falling commodity prices, financial chicanery, and the fact that the money and power were in London, held by people who didn't care about them. Predictably, when their businesses turned sour, the suffering went mostly to the slaves. Working in the plantation fields wasn't the worst place a slave could find himself. Their owners regularly hired their slaves out in task gangs to other colonials. This was generally a terrible experience because the task gang customer had no incentive to have a good relationship with the rented people and typically worked them unmercifully. The slaves were not completely without rights. There was an official called the fiscal, whose job it was to investigate mistreatment and illegal oppression. Having nothing to lose, the slaves were extremely litigious, bombarding the fiscal with an endless stream of complaints. Most, of course, were quickly dismissed, and often the complainers were punished for speaking up. But people in desperate places will do desperate things in their pursuit of justice. And now I see a thing that I was going to put in the blog piece, but forgot to, so I'll just read it out here, trying to improvise, and after I've finished recording this, I'll go back and put it in the blog piece. The slaves actually had some businesses on the side. They were entitled to gardens and pieces of land that were called provision grounds on which they rose crops to feed themselves and to make things to sell in the Georgetown market. And one of the main sources of disputes between masters and slaves was they were supposed to get some time to work on this, and the masters kept cutting it back and then wanting to confiscate the provision grounds to grow sugar on and so on. It was a sad, sad story. But I don't know, I find that term, provision grounds, compelling, evocative, and sad. The women among the slaves had it way worse than the men. There was a culture of casual brutality against them, the slave owners telling each other that the women were troublemakers, recalcitrant, needed, quotes, firm discipline, unquotes. I can't even bring myself to write about the sexual predation and the treatment of these women's children. It's beyond horrible. Demerara was a long way from London, and its rulers found it convenient to ignore many of the edicts from the mother country urging better treatment of the slaves. Those rulers, however, were unsuccessful in preventing the word about the edicts getting out. This pattern of behavior was a key factor in provoking the sense of grievance that led to the rebellion. The slaves came from several different African ethnic groups, and obviously, for at least the first few generations, retained African languages and cultural patterns. There is evidence that the leadership of the rebellion was mostly slaves coming from the Akan, that's A-K-A-N, people, and there's a link in there, called Coromanti by the colonialists. But of these patterns and structures among the slaves, we know almost nothing because their owners didn't care and they had no incentive to share. The missionaries, who were eager to tell the slave side of the story, ignored the history and the internal culture. Sadly, these stories seem to have been lost. After my reading, I feel I know Ray and Smith pretty well. I have much less insight into the real protagonists, Kwamina and Jack. That's just the way the history is. It's not fair. The British post-rebellion political struggles focused around the person of John Smith and his trial and death. The slaves were given no agency by either side. It is shocking, but true, that it took the imprisonment and death of one not very distinguished white man to launch the forces into motion that in the end led to the abolition of slavery. It's a dark, terrible story, but there are rays of light in it. I am profoundly grateful that I live in an age where my children are at risk neither of becoming slaves nor slavers. Obviously, in the 21st century, we are still trying to find ways to heal the wounds inflicted in our society and culture by slavery. Anti-racism is the price of entry to the community of people trying to heal the wounds, but we're still not very good at it. That's all, folks.